As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide makes simplicity a priority so financial professionals can help their clients achieve their retirement goals. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.
Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene with David Gura. Daily, we bring you insight from the best of economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg.
He has made this. How many book interviews have you done? I mean, are you up to 142 yet?
But I've done plenty.
The book has been out, and he has done plenty of interviews. It is launched to the top of the New York Times bestseller list. Bill Gates helping that out, saying that this provides guidance. I want to go to Mr. Gates here in a moment. Principals, Ray Dalio, of course, with Bridgewater. And yes, we'll talk about the investment environment, alternative assets and that in a moment. Congratulations, Ray. And what I want to know, and you finished strong in your book with your final chapter, which is the great mystery here. And for heaven's sake, don't overlook governance. Can you take the principles of an entrepreneurial guy like you and can you bring them over to big corporations like Microsoft?
Any organization can determine how the people in the organization are going to deal with each other, right? I mean, I think that that's the most important thing. Write down your principles, which are basically the recipes for success, and agree on them so that you can have an idea meritocracy. What I'm arguing is that an idea meritocracy is the best way to have an organization. And I learned that in the markets. Because in order to be successful in the markets, I know that I don't have all the answers. Mm-hmm. I learned humility.
Exactly.
And that what I wanted to do is to have the best independent thinkers, people who will disagree with me,
right,
and know how to reach agreement. So I need to have the rules of the game clear, okay, so we could have that independent thinking.
So you and Dom Barton of McKinsey go into a given big blue chip company. Let's pick on Mr. Dimon, and I guess he liked your book too. Jamie Dimon and J.P. Morgan. You guys go into J.P. Morgan. Are you going to give everybody at J.P. Morgan an iPad and have them judge each meeting?
No, I think.
I mean, if I'm with Michael Feroli, David Gura, I'm going to be like, Feroli, you were terrible there on potential GDP.
I think the basic question is whether you're going to have an idea meritocracy. Forget the iPad thing. Forget any of the tools thing.
Right.
The question is, if you and I were going to have a partnership, how are we going to be with each other?
Right.
You better write down the rules. And I'm saying that the better way to do it is to have an idea meritocracy. And what that means is, how do you know if there's a disagreement? How do you know whether you're right or wrong? And how do you get to the better
right
answer than you could have individually, right?
Yeah.
So that's a fundamental notion. And if you look, there are two types of systems you ordinarily can have, like the autocracy where the boss is always right, and then you're going to dictate it, and everybody walks around thinking whatever they
right
think, or you're going to have a democracy. You can't have You can't have a democracy where a one man, one vote is. So how do you get through a disagreement intelligently?
Okay, we've got radical transparency here, too. David Gura and I are not on speaking terms. David, jump in here.
Ray, you emphasized several times in the book the need to write things down, to think about this, to be self-aware of one's own principles, and you write about how you wish you could look back at other leaders in business and economics and government and get their sense of principles. How do you get that kind of self-awareness, or how do you begin to think about things in this sort of way?
Well, I could describe how I got it. I wrote down every time I made a decision, I wrote down the reason I made the decision. I closed the trade and I reflected on it. And then I began to see that if I could take those criteria, I could test how they would have performed in the past. That opened my eyes. Then I began to have discussions with other people about the people I work with on what are our criteria, not just what is our decision. And then mm-hmm. When I found that we could agree on the criteria, I found that we could put them into algorithms. And we could take those algorithms and then have the computer make decisions in parallel with us. And that was mind-blowing, right? So if you don't know your criteria for making decisions and you don't have it written down and you have it clear, you're just going to walk into the snowstorm every day and you're going to see this blizzard of stuff coming at you and you won't know how to deal with it. If you have a game plan and you start to realize that everything that comes at you is another one of those, in other words, it happens over and over again, and what's your game plan? Those are principles, and that's powerful.
How did you come to the awareness that these could be things for self-improvement, they could be things that define how you live your life personally, and in business, and yet they could also be transferred to the company that you're running, that they were more universally applicable than you might have thought at the beginning?
Be clear on your criteria.
Uh-huh.
Right? Be clear on your criteria. If you're clear on your criteria, you write down your recipes. Not only do you know them, and they can be converted into algorithms, or you're clear with each other on how to behave, and when something comes along, you're strategic, and you're not just in the blizzard. That is what I'm passing along. Mm-hmm. In other words, whatever success I had in life has not been due to me, okay? It's been due to the principles that are in that book.
One more question on principles, and I want to move on. I want to know what's in this for the kid walking into Long Island University. He's 17. He's 18. He grew up in Queens with a wonderfully gifted jazz musician father. That kid walks in. What does a 17 or 18-year-old get out of principles?
For me, it was, I didn't have the approach to principles then, right? I just dove into life, and then I encountered things. And then years later, I discovered that I would write those things down, and that's kind of the magic. And so this is just a cookbook of the principles mm-hmm. that work for me. And forget about me. I'm recommending to you, and I'm asking other people. I won't list the people,
right.
Bill Gates, Jamie Dimon, people like Mike Bloomberg. If they wrote down their recipes for success of what they did and people could look at them, it would be tremendous for other people.
I'm going to give you major marks for the individual nature of your book. This is a naked book, principles, and the individual treatment of it is first rate. I want to go now to how you apply this over to investments. Once again, we're in a period where your community, the hedge fund community, used to double-digit net returns to clients. It ain't happening. We're in a single digit with even some negative numbers for hedge funds. How long can the community put up with this underperformance before the money starts walking out the door?
I think it's worth taking a second and saying, what is the character of the environment?
Totally agree.
Okay. And then that applies to things. So, first, low volatility of inflation. Low volatility of economic growth, low volatility of interest rate changes, which means low volatility of markets.
Agreed, and on a risk parity strategy as you invented, it's tough.
No, because our returns for risk parity this year have been excellent, in other words, normal. And that's because the expected return of equities, the actual return of equities, and the actual return of bonds relative to the return of cash in most asset mm-hmm. classes continues to have a premium. The worst asset class you can have is cash.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And as long as, and throughout history, the only time that cash hasn't been mm-hmm. the right, has been the better investment than a diversified portfolio of other assets has been during terrible economic conditions that result in reversals like 2008. So, but let me answer your question in terms of the environment, mm-hmm. right? By low in volatility in terms of growth, and there's reasons for it,
right.
Low volatility of inflation and low volatility of interest rates, short-term interest mm-hmm. rates, we're in a situation that, generally speaking, we have a low volatile environment and we have a low return environment. We have those things for structural reasons.
Okay, then Ray Dalio, if I'm at Verizon walked in the door years ago and put their faith behind you. I got an SPX back 12 months up 19.8%, the Dow up 28%. That's the pressure the people that admire you face. Because I got straight equities, passive fund, Vanguard, killing it. How do you respond to that?
First of all, our clients love us because of we separate alpha and beta. This
Agreed.
Is important.
Okay.
Just let me explain that.
That's
that,
important.
Okay? We have two types of funds. We have a pure alpha fund in which the individual can take that alpha and attach it to any asset class.
Okay.
So they can set an equity benchmark and put the alpha on top of that benchmark. In 16 out of the last 16 years, we have had positive alpha. So if they chose an equity benchmark and they put that alpha, they would have had an alpha that's positive, whatever you attach it
to. Tell me about beta.
And beta is the structure, the passive portfolio. What portfolio do you want? So we have an all-weather portfolio, which is our risk parity portfolio we described.
World acclaimed.
Okay, and that is our passive beta. So one can choose what we think is the best beta portfolio. Therefore, there's no alpha. Alpha is the deviation from the benchmark to add more value. So you can have the best beta portfolio, or you can have the what we believe is the best alpha portfolio. So because we've performed, had positive expected alpha in 16 out of the last 16 years, and we've done and had 23 out of the last, now it's less than it has been.
Okay.
But they don't compare it to equities at the time, right? Because in other words, it's above equities is the way that they look at it. It's up to them to choose whether they want the equity benchmark.
If you're just joining us, Ray Dalio with us. We've got lots more to talk about. We'll continue with Mr. Dalio of Bridgewater. The book is Principles, doing better than... Have you sold the movie rights yet? Is there going to be a movie? Who's playing Ray Dalio?
No movie
rights? Damn! Ray Dalio with us, and we will continue.
Nobody ever says, make it complicated. That is why Nationwide makes simplicity a priority. By providing financial professionals with straightforward, client-ready resources. From clear strategies to help clients meet retirement savings and income needs, to ways to cover rising healthcare costs and more. Nationwide simplifies planning so more time can be spent helping clients. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
On Bloomberg Radio, we welcome all of you on Bloomberg Television worldwide. If I can get the tomb over you, it's like the Old and the New Testament. Principals Ray Dalio, and both David Gurr and I agree, there's some huge individual initiative in here to think better and do better over the career of Mr. Dalio, of course, at Bridgewater. Ray, I want to ask one more financial question here that we've been talking on, and I know David wants to go to so much of what the nation is looking at right now. We see every day, Kathy Burton and our team in hedge funds, people returning money from hedge funds. Have you ever had to do that? Have you ever had to return money to investors because things just don't feel good right now? Anything like that?
We have caps, and we've always had caps, and we've returned money over a long period of time.
Yeah. Within this is the recent underperformance of hedge funds and the pressure to get back. What do you do? Just wait? Do you take vacations waiting to get back to the right volatile environment?
I think I should explain a little bit about how it works, right?
Please.
For us, we separate alpha and beta, right? So there's alpha, which is the value added, and that's a pure alpha fund, and then people can attach that to whatever beta they want. So if they say, I want equities, plus your alpha and your pure alpha fund, they get the alpha plus whatever the beta is. If they have cash and they compare it with an equity return, that's not a smart thing to do. So our institutional clients compare it with the asset class that they put it against. And so because we've added value in 16 or the last 16 years and we're adding value, less than we normally do because volatility's been less, but still we're added value, net of fees, they're getting positive alpha. So they have, in our case, they tend to give us money whenever there's an opportunity to give us money. Now, the question is, what is a hedge fund, right? If a hedge fund is compared against the stock and you're having a cash and you're producing that value added and you're disappointed, then you're probably naive. If that entity is meant to beat the equity markets or something, then that's the passive. So you have to pick. The investor's got to pick one way or another, because when the bear market comes along, how do they deal with the bear market? So it's, it becomes a strategic question. Right. I think the smart investor, institutional investors are ours, know how to separate alpha and beta and make that.
I got to make news here this morning. Are you predicting a bear market? It seems like every Friday all the doom and the gloom comes out of higher interest rates, lower stock prices. Can Ray Dalio predict negative 18% in the equity markets?
No, we've been long equity markets, and we're, you know, without getting too much into our positions.
Why not? Let's get into those positions.
I could tell you, because we don't get into our positions. That's okay. Why not. But anyway, I'm saying no, the answer to your question. I mean, eventually it comes along, but we're in a different environment now. Here's the difference. Okay.
And then David, jump in here.
From 2008 until 2017, we were in a certain type of environment. And that environment, it was one in which there was the pushing of interest rates down to the point of creating negative interest rates, and with a positive carry, by doing quantitative easing to push money into the system. 2017 is the transition of an ending of all of that all around the world. And we are entering a new era in which there is going to be, and there is, the raising of interest rates and the reducing of quantitative easing. That action that they took in that produced significantly bad real interest rates. I mean, real interest rates today, 10-year on the 10-year real interest rates are about 0.5%.
Yeah, next to nothing.
Next to nothing. And the break-even inflation rate for 10 years is about 1.8%. So that's, those numbers are very low because of, let's call it, repression in order to get the economy to do that. We are now in a transition, a whole different environment. That's the equivalent of entering the late stage of the cycle, and that's when there's a tightening. Tightenings become progressively more concerning because as you move along, they're more and more difficult to get perfect. Yeah. So as we're progressing, we are entering a period of greater risk and the nature of the market. So when you look at the bond market right now, there is risk in the bond market. There looks to me as a significant amount of risk in the bond market. As that now, so now let's go to the policies that are behind.
Well, let's bring in David. Go to the policies. The good news is Ray Dalio is not on the short list at the Fed.
Well, on that note, central bank squarely in focus here. We just heard from the ECB. We're waiting to hear who the president's going to pick to lead the Fed. Let me ask you a two-part question. How much does personality matter at the Federal Reserve? I look at John Taylor and think, maybe he's a Ray Dalio kind of guy. He's got rules or principles of his own that he's held throughout his career. And on that note, what would you say to the next chair of the Fed to what he or she needs to focus on when it comes to the health of the U.S. economy?
Ooh, bunch of questions in there. So personality, again, I think the real question is principles. If you were to write them down and articulate them and then discuss them through history over a period of time, I think that's a good thing. They also have very different principles, and so such as matters in terms of quantitative easing and also whether it's too tight and too loose. So I do think it can matter a lot in terms of what the monetary policy is, particularly the notion of about the quantitative easing and whether it's too tight or too easy. It can matter a lot. And then we have the pace at which, from Fed policy, since we're talking about it, the pace at which there's an unwinding of the balance sheet. You know, I look at those numbers, and I don't think they're going to be able to continue to that pace because it's equivalent of something like 2.5% of GDP. And if you have that happening at the same time as there's increased budget deficits, we could have a budget deficit increase of another 1.5% of GDP. That's a big number in the supply demand of bonds. I mean, think about that. Okay, there's going to be that amount of effective selling of credit by the Federal Reserve, a big number.
Are you predicting that with the tax reform proposed, as Douglas Holtz Eakin talks about, we're going out to 5, 6, or 7% of deficit to GDP?
We will almost certainly have a significant move in that direction. So you could even see it in the market action. In other words, on days where it looks like they're making more progress, the bond market's more inclined to sell off. Days that they're making less progress, the bond market. Because there's going to be probably a larger deficit, and that means more selling of bonds. At the same time as there's more selling of bonds by the Federal Reserve in terms of the balance sheet change. Now, I think they'll be cautious in this, but when you're in this part of the cycle, it's very delicate. And this is not just the Fed. This is what the movement in the ECB is going to be analogous to that. So we're talking now, today's meeting is what is the pace of doing that, but we know the direction. And if you move further along, you know the direction. You know the direction in Japan a little bit slower. You know the direction in China. As we have go from the 19th People's Congress and you go beyond it, there's going to be more of a tightening of credit. So the complexion of the world that we're in is changing in a profound way. Every decade practically has defining characteristics. You know, the 60s was a period of strong growth, not much inflation. Okay. 70s.
This is in the
we're going to have a period. We're going to enter a new period that's going to be quite different than the one that we've been in.
I got eight ways to go here. We're running out of time because your answers are too long. You've got to work on that. You got to go to interview camp and do shorter answers. I'm kidding. Ray, we just interviewed Richard Thaler, the Nobel Prize winner in behavioral economics. In the back of your book, Principles, you have in your bibliography the giant, Mr. Kahneman of Princeton, Thinking Fast, Thinking Slow. What have you learned from the behavioral economists that you brought over to your book, Principles?
I learned that there are two U's in everybody, right? There's the upper level thoughtful you that's not emotionally carried away. And there's the lower level you, which is a part of the brain, the animal brain, that has that emotional carried away, but also a lot of good things like inspiration and intuition come from that. And I've learned how important it is to go slow and reconcile those two things to determine what you want. And that is the exercise. In other words, when I'm in the heat of the moment and I'm dealing with things, and then I instead come out of that heat of the moment and I've slowed down and I write down my criteria for making decisions and I build a decision-making system. So it's like playing poker that I know if I operated in this way, I could know what the results are. I'm in a position that I can execute that, like creating a computer chess game. That's been great for me.
Can we do this for like 6 hours? I got too many questions to go. I want to talk about Ed Thorpe and MIT.
There'll be another book, Tom.
There'll be another book. Yeah. When is the next book out?
Oh, probably on economic and investment principles, probably a year and a half.
Well, we wait for the movie. It'll be great. Principles, Ray Dalio, thank you so much. Really, really interesting book on the individual moving through life with a lot of lessons learned from Mr. Dalio. He, of course, runs a small investment shop up in Connecticut called Bridgewater as well. Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Subscribe and listen to interviews on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. I'm on Twitter at Tom Keene. David Gura is at David Gura. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.